Hello, and welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. I'm Bruce Edwards.
The theme or the underlying idea behind the book is if you want to preserve globalization, pull back governance as far as possible.
In his new book, The Third Pillar, How Markets and the State Leave the Community Behind, economist Raghuram Rajan says empowering communities is the key to making globalization work for more people.
I wanted to make it as paradoxical as possible, that localism is the answer to globalization. So if you're looking for a clean sort of extreme, this book doesn't offer it. It says the world is complicated. And you always have to balance one thing against the other.
Raghuram Rajan is a distinguished professor of finance at the University of Chicago, the former head of India's central bank, and a former chief economist at the IMF, where he was invited to talk about the third pillar, his new book.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It is a pleasure to be back here with friends once again, and I recognize many friends from the IMF. Let me sort of talk a little bit about why I wrote this book. I, like many others, was perturbed at the direction the global economy was taking. Of course, the sequence of crises, the conditions post-crisis in much of the world, And trying to understand what was driving this general malaise, what was the big challenge to capitalism. Of course, in my previous book, I'd talked about the issues of inequality and so on. But in a sense, I was trying to understand what made capitalism work so well for the 60 or 70 years after the after World War II, and why would those underpinnings being challenged. And you know, for those who know me, you know me as broadly a conservative type, so I'm not for revolution, but I am indeed for reform, where we can make reforms so as to make the system work again. And it was my view that the system works so well, what's gone wrong? And to do that, we have to go back to the beginning. So, I started with the standard view of capitalism that really, through much of the 20th century, the debate was about how much markets, how much government. And depending on which sort of system you espoused, it was either entirely about free and competitive markets, and of course, if you're at the University of Chicago, that's all it's about. If you're elsewhere, you have a government which enforces property rights and contracts. Some people would say not much more. Other people would talk about the whole welfare state, which is also necessary for capitalism. But it seems to me in these views, we leave out, in many ways, a third pillar, that is the community, or more broadly, the social structure, which prepares people for participation in the capitalist economy. You're not born into it. You typically walk into the capitalist economy at age 21, 22, fully prepared to participate in markets. So let's talk about the structures that help you participate. But also these structures are extremely important when other structures fail as a kind of safety net, as a protection, when in fact the formal structures don't work. And so this whole apparatus, which we typically ignore, works to make capitalism more viable and better for the mass of people. But also importantly, and through democracy, helps to course correct capitalism when it veers off track and make it work for the many. Because in some sense, the popularity of capitalism is the fact that it gives opportunity to the many. And when it stops doing that, that's when it loses popular support. That's when the many stop supporting capitalism. And I would argue the post-war balance that we saw between the pillars, the liberal market democracy, and each of these words is important, liberal in the sense of a government which was, on the one hand, protective of security and so on, but at the same time,
limited in the sense that people had freedom. It wasn't an oppressive government. Market, obvious what that means. And democracy, that democracy is also central to capitalism working. I think this balance worked quite well in industrial countries, which is why many people in emerging markets, this was the ideal we were trying to reach. This was what we were trying to do when we reformed our countries. We were going there. And for many of us, it has been very disappointing that now industrial countries are saying, no, no, this is not an appropriate goal. We need something else. And they're revisiting some of the mistakes we made in the past, which held us back, democratic socialism, for example. So the question is, what is making industrial countries rethink? And one of the points I want to make in this book is really the system works as a balance. It's not a menu where you can pick one thing from here, one thing from there, and expect things to work. For example, just to make this point early on, you cannot say we want a socialist economy and at the same time say we want democracy. It's very hard. And I would argue there is a lesson there. You cannot, it's not a menu. It works as a balance. These things hold each other in check, and I'll come to that in just a second. But that's part of what the book is trying to establish. There is a broader structure. So let's get definitions out of the way, because sometimes they can be confusing. By the state, which is one of the three pillars, I imply the usual executive, judiciary, and legislature. Its functions since the beginning of history has been security and justice, but more recently, as markets are more demanding of the capabilities that people should have, the state has moved into providing those capabilities. Schooling, for example, in a number of countries is provided for by the state. But also, as market volatility increased in the 19th century, people wanted the state to protect them not against external enemies as much as market volatility. So the role of the state in buffering volatility, unemployment insurance, old age insurance, healthcare, et cetera, et cetera. So pre-market support, helping you prepare for the market, post-market support, what happens if you fall off? The state has moved into all that. Markets, of course, we talk about the usual markets, and their primary function is to provide higher efficiency, higher productivity, and of course, greater choice and innovation. And finally, the community. To prevent the book from getting longer than it already is, I had to pick what I meant by community, because there's so many views of community. And I picked what most people would identify as their community. In fact, 70% of people in Britain identify the neighborhood, their village, their municipality as their community, the proximate community, the people who surround you. And I include in this local government and local institutions like schools. Now, some people, of course, in big cosmopolitan cities no longer think that community matters. Many of my colleagues think that way. But for most people in a country, it still does matter. They're still citizens of somewhere, where the somewhere is the people around them. And it also turns out, even in a large open country like the United States, it matters. The work that Raj Chetty has done, for example, with co-authors, suggests that if you move from a not-so-good community to a better community when you're young, your parents move you, it turns out that your life chances improve tremendously based on the number of years you spend in the new community. The community does affect how you develop the skills and the capabilities that prepare you for the market economy. Now, you might argue, why community? After all, the state already does much of this, markets do much of that. Why do we still need the community? And the community we need because it fills holes. It fills holes, it's based on relationships, not contracts. One example of this was in Southern Europe when we had the Great Recession. People ran out of unemployment insurance. They ran out of their savings. Where did they go? They went back to their village. They went back to their family. And they stayed there for a number of years. The community, again, coming to fill in the holes left because the formal structure, the safety net that the government puts together, is not enough. And of course, the community forms the basis for political organization. Democratic protest starts at the community level and moves up, and therefore that's an important role for the community. Now, I don't want to rule out other forms of community. We have virtual communities. I would argue still at this point there's less trust between members of a virtual community. There's less engagement. It's good for mass protest, but for sustained organized protest, you need something more like a proximate community, a proximate organization. So this is the balance that I think we achieved with the liberal market democracy, and a balance which has gotten perturbed, and I'll talk about why. First, markets provide independent countervailing power to the power of the state, and that's extremely important. That's why I think no socialist economy is that democratic, because you need independence from the state. An independent private sector is extremely important for keeping the state in check. But the other aspect, which is very important, is that there's a tendency of the state and markets to collude, big players in the market and the state to collude. And there it's important for democratic impulses to try and keep them apart, because the broader democracy doesn't benefit from the collusion of the powerful. Now, this is something that Adam Smith talked about. People sort of sometimes, without reading The Wealth of Nations, think it's sort of a precursor to Ayn Rand. Far from it. The businessman in Adam Smith is certainly, you know, great from the perspective of trying to enhance productivity and efficiency, but has a constant need to try and cartelize, to work with government. After all, you know, The Wealth of Nations was written against mercantilism. One of the biggest concerns that Adam Smith had was, in a sense, the narrowing of trade as a result of mercantilist policies. And so again and again, he talks about collusion as the big problem of capitalism, collusion between the capitalists themselves, but also between the capitalists and the state. And one of the important aspects of liberal market democracy, I think, is the periodic uprising of people to say there's too much collusion. And I think this is a healthy part of capitalism. It tries to keep the playing field relatively open, relatively capable of generating competition. It's very important for capitalism to work for the many. And finally, I would argue, and this is something that I try and argue in the book, that the community provides values and norms for the market. And this may seem, you know, it's not that values and norms are unchanging, as many of you know. Today, for example, in capitalist markets, the dominant value is shareholder value maximization, something enunciated by Milton Friedman in the early 70s. But, you know, shareholder value maximization or profit maximization would have been a sin in medieval Europe. It was a sin of avarice, and you weren't allowed to charge anything more than the just price, the price that kept you in your station, but nothing more. Profit maximization was actually a bad thing then. And I talk a little bit about how circumstances change, and it may be changing once again. So the point here is all these pillars work with each other and create a balance. So what causes imbalance? Today, what I would argue is the information and communications technology revolution is what is front and center challenging us. And let me talk about three ways it's doing it. First, of course, it's clear to everybody in this room that it has made trade easier by slicing and dicing up the supply chain and by reducing the cost of transportation, reducing the cost of communication. This has made trade easier. But one of the things that is less often recognized, of course, if you think about it, it's clear in a minute, is that this has removed the protections for manufacturing. It used to be the manufacturing worker was protected by the fact that, you know, the related services, R&D, design, all that had to be done in an industrial country, so manufacturing was also protected to some extent. You couldn't outsource manufacturing. Once you can break up the supply chain, you can outsource to wherever it's done cheapest. But even as those middle-income manufacturing jobs have disappeared, middle-income service jobs are also being automated away. A classic example is that of a tax accountant. Used to be paid for knowing every last arcane detail of the tax code. Today, TurboTax, which costs $50,
has every last detail. You don't need the tax accountant. You need some basic knowledge of computers. Some people don't have that, so it creates a job. For the low-skilled person who has knowledge of computers, has no knowledge of the tax code, but can use TurboTax to do your taxes for you, this reflects a number of things. First, it's not that jobs have disappeared. We have new jobs, that low low-skilled person doing taxes for a lot of people who don't want to use computers. They're benefiting from additional jobs, but these are, of course, low-paid jobs. The middle-income tax accountant has disappeared, but the high-income tax lawyer who's doing shelters for everybody across the globe now has a thriving business because that tax accountant has a global market. And what this means is that we have a skewed income distribution with the middle falling out, the low end well populated. That's why we have, you know, very low levels of unemployment. But the upper end, to get there, you have to make a big jump in terms of education. Even within the upper end, it's getting further sliced and diced. So the very upper end makes much more. And to understand that, to understand the superstar nature of professions, look at these two women. The woman on the left is Elizabeth Billington. She was a star of the London Opera in 1801. I'm sure you knew that, right? She filled the opera house. And in the 1801 season, she earned between 10,000 and 15,000 pounds. That, in today's money, is about $1 million. The woman on the right, Taylor Swift. And she made $170 million in 2016. Why does Taylor Swift make 170 times the diva of 1801? Because the diva of 1801 worked in an opera house which at best could accommodate 100,000 people during the entire season. Taylor Swift's latest song has been downloaded close to 6 billion times. Billion, right? You have an entirely bigger market today if you are at the very top. And therefore, the rewards to being there, whether you're servicing a large market in services or in the arts, is that you get very high incomes. We have superstar professions, and that skewed the incomes at the very top even more. So that's the effect of markets, at least some of the effects of the ICT revolution. Now, one of the things I point to in the book is that that's an effect on markets, but we often don't recognize that the state grows with the market. That the state and markets are substitutes in some places. This was the whole debate in the 20th century, socialism versus capitalism. But they also grow together, and this is Danny Roderick's sort of point, that you see the size of government and plot it against income, there's a positive correlation. That's because some of the more prosperous countries have bigger governments. But one of the things that happens, now Danny pointed to the volatility of markets, which is why government grew bigger. But governance is another reason why government grows bigger when markets grow. Not only bigger, but more centralized. Think about market participants. They want seamless regulation across markets. They want the ability to traverse markets easily. They don't want to stop at borders. So as markets get more integrated, governance not only grows, but it grows out of the locality into centralized areas. Think about bank capital. When the bank operated entirely in the town, the town set bank capital requirements. As banks operated in the state set capital requirements. As banks operated in the country started setting capital requirements. Today, we set capital requirements in Basel. Now, you know, people would protest and say we don't really set them there. Yes, we do. We negotiate the capital requirements, then each of us sells it back in our country. This is what we decided at Basel, and we must take it because it comes after a deep negotiation. The point is, we have lost control in countries over this process, but not just in countries. We have lost control in communities. When you think about the cry in Brexit, it is take back control, because too much is determined in Europe, in the euro area, but not enough in London. But Brexit is not just about, you know, take back control in London from what's happening in the euro area. London, of course, voted for Remain. It didn't want to exit. It's Northern England which says, we want to take back control even from England. We want to take control from London back into our communities. In many ways, you could argue these populist movements are an attempt to take back control, and that's because in a sense, the integration of markets does that to you. But the third thing I want to argue is that technological change not only has it led to this disempowerment of the local into the national, into the global, but it's also created tremendous pressure in certain localities to adapt. Now, when you are in a situation where you need better schooling, and you're a couple trying to decide where you keep your, where you put your kids in school, today, what decision will you make? Almost surely, if you're in a big crowded city, you will look for the best public schools, but if they don't exist, you'd put them in private schools. But if you are, you have the option of going to the suburbs. In the US, where will you go? Typically, I would argue you would go to the richest suburb you can afford. Because in that richest suburb, the parents of kids are largely likely to be professionals like you. They're going to have the kind of environment at home which teaches their kids many more words than a working class household. Their kids are going to be healthier because they're going to get better food up front. They're not going to be put in front of the TV as often as in a working class household. They're going to be better prepared. And in fact, my colleague Jim Heckman at Chicago says that, you know, you're pretty much done for life at age 5. Now, I think the work that Raj Shetty has done says there's a little more hope. But nevertheless, the point is early childhood matters. And who gives you that capability in early childhood? It's your family and the community you grow up in. So the point here is that Heckman and Shetty come together to say that the environment matters. But if the environment matters so much, what you get is professionals saying, I want to go to the best environment for my kids. And you get what I call the secession of the successful. That increasingly middle-class communities, which had a variety of incomes represented in that community, are morphing into communities of the very rich and communities of the left behind, which typically are much poorer. And you see that in community across community. It's empirically documented. It's also, according to some studies, driven primarily by parents of kids who are trying to figure out where they can get the best outcomes for their kids. The disintegration of the mixed community is even more problematic because it changes life opportunities for those left behind. And that's essentially the antithesis of capitalism, which is a level playing field for everyone. The people left behind simply don't have a level playing field. And no wonder they're angry, right? Now, of course, that anger is directed against the corrupt elite. It's directed against minorities. It's directed against cheating nations who sell goods at below market prices. But the fundamental rationale for that anger, that we don't have a chance, is not misplaced. It is real. And it is something that needs to be addressed. Now, I would argue that populist nationalism doesn't have the answers, right? I mean, clearly, many in this room would agree that given technological change is the bigger force, 4 out of 5 jobs are lost because of technological change rather than because of trade, that erecting barriers to trade is not going to solve the problem. You still have that insidious effect of technological change coming behind the trade barriers and changing the nature of work. So we do need to adapt to the changing nature of work, which means a whole set of new skills for people. Moreover, if you look ahead, you know, the guys advocating sort of an end to immigration clearly don't recognize that with aging populations, somebody has to pay for the entitlements. And those entitlements were set at a time of great prosperity and are much less affordable in a time of shrinking growth and shrinking labor forces. So immigration in the longer run will be necessary for industrial countries. I'm not saying uncontrolled immigration, but some immigration would be necessary given where we are. Robots are not going to cut it. And therefore, it seems silly at this point to try and reverse all that with very high walls to immigration. And furthermore, if you look ahead, with aging populations, where is demand going to come from? It's typically going to come from other parts of the world, younger parts of the world, hungrier parts of the world where investment is going to be very important. And that means the rest. And if you are going to be dependent on the rest, isn't it silly erecting barriers today? So we need to recognize the underlying tensions, but I think we need to offer alternatives.
And of course, if we want to address global problems like climate change, we need to do work that brings countries together than sets them apart. So I will end with sort of a quick overview of my quote-unquote solutions. I would argue that one of the things we need to combat the effects of integrated markets to protect that continuing integration, to keep the world open, is to reverse the trend for integration of sovereignty to the extent possible. Again, that to the extent possible is important. I would argue what we need really at the national level is perhaps more sovereignty over matters that concern a country, but it has to be exercised responsibly, and this is something that I'm happy to develop. At the national level, of course, it seems to me a system that works for mixed countries is civic nationalism, where you don't insist that only a certain ethnic or cultural group has rights to citizenship, but citizenship belongs to anybody who adheres to the values of that nation. And finally, in this idea of pushing back power, it doesn't remain at the center, but it goes back to the locality. Now, this is as much because I think that bottom-up policies are more likely to have traction in this world where every region has a differentiated challenge, has a different need to respond to the effects of globalization and technological change, but also from a social perspective. It seems to me that when you have a crumbling community, you have all sorts of radical alternative communities which start becoming attractive. Why is it that nationalism is becoming more important and attractive at this time? Often because you don't have as much of a sense of identity from looking around the crumbling area that you're in. And if we are to offset some of the effects, the adverse effects of nationalism, I would argue that we need to strengthen the community once again. So to end, I mean, what I emphasize is localism. Localism because it seems to me with different communities affected differentially, one-size-fits-all national policies are unlikely to work. We need to decentralize far more, and that requires reversing some of the forces which have been happening so far, giving more power. Now, the question is there somebody to take that power? Are there capable people in the local communities? And in some places, there aren't. And what we have to do is try and find ways that talented people go back to the communities they came from and can regenerate and revitalize those communities. So how do we keep and develop good people in communities? How do you keep parents from not leaving deteriorating communities because they care about their children's future? These are some of the ideas we need to think about. I talk a little bit about possibilities in the book. Of course, local engagement will be improved if you have more local powers. So I would argue for more decentralization. And third, we need various forms of engagement to get the community together. Technology can help. For example, there are now apps which allow you to point to problems in your neighborhood. Here's a pothole. Let me click it. It goes up onto the municipality's website, and then it remains there till they fix it. And then it displays when they fixed it. So your ability to control your local official, as well as the ability of the center to keep control over the money that goes to them and their spending is much better now. So the old worries about empowering the local, or these guys are going to be corrupt, or these guys are going to be tyrants, I think that holds less water today, given the kinds of things technology can do. So I would say we need to focus on trying to revitalize by empowering and decentralizing. But we also need to not abandon these communities, which means create infrastructure, virtual and physical. In a sense, I would, and let me stop here, that what we really have in industrial countries is a renewed problem of underdevelopment. We have huge pockets of underdevelopment in industrial countries. And underdevelopment is a hard problem to fix. Typically, policies from the outside, hey, you do this, you do that, have rarely worked. Underdevelopment gets fixed when there's a move from inside to change the environment, to deal with the local problems. This is something we have to recognize. Every region within a country and every community has different problems. And one of the communities I highlight is the Pilsen community in Chicago. Its problem was crime. It had 21 gangs in the space of a mile and a half. It had a murder rate of 60 per 100,000 per year, which is, I mean, you can guess them, gauge the magnitude when you know that the death rate on the Eastern Front during World War II was something like 100 per 100,000 per year. So it was virtually a war zone. And with that level of crime, no matter what opportunity zone, tax incentives, this, that you give, nobody's going to do open business there. You first had to deal with the crime. And what I document is sort of the success story in Pilsen as they dealt with bringing down the crime, as they worked as a community, first to close down the bars where the criminals congregated, next to crowd out the criminals by coming out on the streets when they saw criminal incidents, and bringing down the crime so much that today they have the reverse problem. Too many people want to come into the community, rents are going up, prices are going up, and they have the problem of gentrification, which is not a bad problem to have to deal with. The broader point I'm trying to make, and I'll end here, is that if we have to deal with this problem of underdevelopment in industrial countries and the revulsion against capitalism, we have to make sure that people have a better chance. And that better chance starts not with necessarily a grand central program, but often local programs on how to regenerate communities, how to regenerate the schools, how to fix the problem of lack of economic activity. And I would say, therefore, decentralization is something that is an important facet of this. Let me stop there.
Raghuram Rajan is a distinguished professor of finance at the University of Chicago. He's also the former head of India's Central Bank and a former IMF chief economist. His new book, The Third Pillar, How Markets and the State Leave the Community Behind, is published by Penguin Random House. If you like this podcast, look for us on Spotify or on your favorite podcast app. Just search for IMF Podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast. Thank you.